Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Monday, December the 4th. And today we're going to chat with our friend Richard Baer, chief political correspondent at The American Thinker. We're going to get into a lot of topics. Obviously, this whole scandal, I mean, this crisis, whatever you want to call it, in Washington with the Mueller probe and the FBI. And I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. You know, it's like it's changing every 5 seconds. It's hard to keep up with it. And it just doesn't seem like anybody's helping. Everybody's accusing everybody of everything. It would be nice if everybody would just take a break, including the president, for a day or two and just kind of let things settle a little bit. We're also going to talk about the tax plan. I would have to say that the reaction to the tax plan based on the markets today was positive. And certainly the reaction in the business community seems to be positive. So I think it was a step in the right direction. And then, of course, we're going to be talking about some news that is supposed to happen this week, or at least they tell us that President Trump will be naming Jerusalem recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So quite a bit to get into with our friend Richard. How are you, Richard? Welcome to the show.
Doing fine, Sylvia. Nice to be back on.
Well, how's the weather up in the Windy City? I was talking to a friend in Minnesota, and he said it was pretty warm on Friday.
Yeah, well, we had 60s today, but tomorrow it looks like this mild fall is going to end. It's going to drop about 25 degrees and get cooler from there. So
more Illinois weather. I guess more Michigan, Lake Michigan weather, right?
That's right. Yep.
More of that. Well, let me give you lots of topics to get into tonight, and I want to give you the easy one first.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this would be pretty complicated, but everything else is so complicated these days. But there's talk that President Trump on Wednesday is going to be announcing that we will now name or accept Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And I was wondering if you could explain the significance of that to – well, first of all, if it's going to happen. We're not sure if it is, but apparently it is. But if it does happen, what is the significance of that to the United States and to Israel itself, Richard?
I mean, it's kind of an absurdity, but the one country in the world where every government right now refuses to have its embassy in the capital that country operates as its capital is Israel. Every country in the world basically has its embassy, if it recognizes Israel, in Tel Aviv. This is in part because the original partition plan under which Israel was created, and it was supposed to be a Palestinian state created, but Palestinians didn't accept it. They went to war with the five Arab countries. And at the end of the conflict in 1949, Israel was admitted to the United Nations, but the status of Jerusalem, which originally was going to be kind of a city governed by international organizations, which didn't make a heck of a lot of sense, has never been settled such that the State Department has a consulate in East Jerusalem to serve the Palestinians, but it has its embassy in Tel Aviv, though it does have meetings with Israeli officials where the Israeli government is, which is in West Jerusalem, which was the Jerusalem that was part of Israel before the Six-Day War. So you have this sort of absurd situation, and Trump... One of the good things about Trump is when he sees absurd situations, he calls them out. And the U.S. Congress and Bill Clinton signed a bill that required the U.S. to move its embassy to Jerusalem. And this was in the 1990s. But it gave each president a waiver opportunity every 6 months to not do it if it believed that it would cause or create problems in foreign affairs. And that's always been the excuse given, that the Arabs would go crazy, they'd scream bloody murder, that if there were any peace talks going on, they'd pull out. So basically, the threat of disruption has kept the U.S. from ever doing it. Trump seems to be trying to thread a needle, and what, at best I can understand what he's going to do is he's going to accept that Jerusalem is Israel's capital without specifically defining whether Jerusalem is the merged city, which has occurred since 1967, or just the original part of Jerusalem that was in Israel before the Six-Day War. I don't think he's going to get into that, but he's going to accept that Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and it's not clear whether he's going to do the second part, which is to say that the U.S. will begin the process of creating an embassy and move the embassy there. My guess is he'll do the first and not the second, but he'll probably do the second over time. This is similar to how he's dealt with the Iran nuclear deal, where he has every few 3 months to indicate whether it's in compliance or not. First couple times he said it was, and he was clearly unhappy about it. The third time he didn't. And I think that's kind of what's going on here. He basically thinks that this is doesn't make a lot of sense, and so he's trying to clarify. He's getting a lot of pushback. You know, all the ambassadors in Arab countries are screaming, as you'd expect. But I think there's a pretty good chance that he'll take that first step.
Yeah. Well, I guess I did not realize the story of this, so thank you so much for clarifying it. I always thought that every country – sort of designated its own capital.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, I agree. I agree.
You know, I just never thought that, you know, it never occurred to me that,
yeah, I mean,
for example,
if France decided that the U.S. capital was in Baltimore. I mean, that's
exactly,
be
yeah.
And they moved
exactly,
to that, in Baltimore. So.
Exactly, or whatever. They said, you know, we'd rather go to San Francisco, so let's open it there.
That's, you know? Right. It's muggy in Washington.
It's muggy.
We like the better views.
Exactly, it's lovely in San Francisco. So let's go out there, and you know, that way we can eat outside, you know, 12 months a year or whatever. But I didn't
realize bullets from the illegals. And
yes, yeah, that they might want to move to San Jose or something now, but
right.
or maybe Sacramento or maybe Seattle or whatever. But it's interesting and. It seems like Israel has to put up with a lot of nonsense from a lot of countries. I mean, it is really unbelievable. I mean, you look at the United Nations. By coincidence, the United Nations celebrates its 72nd anniversary today. I just saw that note. It was approved by the U.S. Senate on this day in 1945. I don't know if it actually opened today, but this is when the Senate approved. The days when the Senate actually approved treaties. I mean, you might have to go back a while to remember that, because we spent 8 years under Obama where we did not realize that the Senate was involved in those things.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's what they're supposed to do. But look at Israel. I mean, in the United Nations. I mean, the United Nations is nothing but an attack society.
Yeah. No, I mean,
Israel. It's ridiculous.
They have permanent committees whose only role is to pass anti-Israel resolutions. They passed 6 last week. You know, and so.
Right. Unbelievable. Well, I like to see it. I like to see it happen. And sometimes, you know, many of us, you know, sometimes the one thing I'll say about Trump, he does have a habit of keeping promises. And that's a good quality. Yeah. He has a good quality in a man. You know, he says, I said this, I'm going to figure out how to do it. Well, let's go to another topic. And that's the tax plan. It passed at 2 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning, and today, I guess, was the first reaction from the markets. The markets were up a lot more in the morning than later, but they did settle on a positive number. Everything I read, everything I hear, Richard, is that the business community likes it. Do you hear that, too?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the business community likes two things. One is the corporate tax rate gets a lot lower, and the repatriation of monies from overseas, where there are several $1 trillion of cash parked by some of the biggest, you know, American companies in the that are operating, can come back at fairly modest rates of taxation, certainly less than, you know, the historic rate, which was the corporate tax rate of 35%. So those are both positive provisions, as is the provision for immediate expensing of equipment, which helps both small and large businesses. So this is mainly a corporate plan. I mean, the changes on the individual level are sort of mixed. I mean, it's clearly different than Bush's tax cut, which had a significant reduction in the top rate. And, you know, the people who always claim that, oh, the rich get all the benefits, top 1% of the population pays about 40% of all income taxes. Top 10% pay 90%. You can't give a big income tax break to people who don't pay income tax. And there's 40 to 50% of the population that doesn't pay income tax. So, you can't win that argument. The class warfare argument is always going to be made by the left. But that's not the issue here. If Trump can get this economy to a state where it's growing, 2.5 to 3.5% a year instead of the Obama growth rate, which was, 1.5 to 2% for 8 years, that'll have enormous impact on jobs, on productivity, and probably also produce enough additional revenue to pay for the tax cut. I mean, the people who do these analyses tend to have sort of static models, which assume that, if this is the current tax rate and you have a lower tax rate, then you get this much less money. They don't assume any significant increase in economic growth. Republicans are counting on that. If they, give these sort of gifts to corporations in terms of the lower rates and they don't get reinvestment in America and they don't get faster economic growth, then, this will have been somewhat wasted. But I think there's a pretty good likelihood that you're going to see a positive reaction to this from the corporate community.
Well, my sense is, Richard, that at this point we have literally handed, it's like on some of this long distance running where, the baton is passed to the next guy. Mm-hmm. And I think here, from this point forward, or from the moment he signs that bill, which I think will be this month, the economy is basically Trump's economy. So we will see what happens. My guess, and just a guess on my part, I'm usually better at predicting baseball than I am the markets. I'm a lot better at that. I accept my limitations, as they say. But I have a funny feeling that come summer, this economy is going to be doing well because we've already had growth of about 3%.
In couple of quarters now. Yep.
In terms of quarters. So let's say we get to maybe 4. And maybe we hit 4, maybe 4.5 by the summer.
I mean, that never occurred in the Obama administration. Usually,
no, it did not. But it also has a huge impact. It has a huge impact, Richard, on deficits also.
Oh, sure.
Because, I don't know what the calculation is, but I think every point of growth erases the deficit so much. And I think that's the other thing, too. Then under the scenario I just described, you've got President Trump with a pretty good economy on Labor Day 2018, and I think under that scenario, the Republicans hold the House and maybe pick up a few seats in the Senate or maybe better. Now, the other scenario, of course, is that we have a recession by the summer or at least a slowdown or nothing significant has happened, and then all bets are off. I mean, who knows what happens in November next year? I happen to think that I'm more inclined to believe the positive scenario, not just because I'm a partisan, but I just think it makes more sense to believe that, but you never know what happens in the economy, Richard.
Yeah. No, I think it's a couple things. One is normally after a big recession pullback like occurred in the financial crisis from 2007 to 2009, the economy responds very positively afterwards when it starts going back up and the rates of increase are very high for a couple of years. That never occurred this time. We never had that sort of rocket fuel of, 3, 4, 5% to – take back some of the decline in gross domestic product that had occurred during the recession. So we had a slow growth economy, which is consistent with a high regulatory economy and an economy with higher tax rates. And Obama pushed through higher tax rates when the Bush ones expired in 2011. So not surprising he didn't get economic growth, but his administration was less concerned with growth than redistributing the pie. That was their orientation, that America is a slow growth country. It's too big, needs to be regulated, needs to be fairer. And Trump's obviously got a different idea. And I think if this goes through, it will have a positive impact. I'm not as confident as you are about the political outcome. And that's because a couple sort of overhangs. One is a lot of Republican congressmen seem to be hanging it up. And the best chance to pick up a seat, if you're the party that's out of power, is when there are open seats. And you know, just the few congressional elections this year, the Republicans have held all the seats, but they were a lot closer than those races had been the last time a Republican incumbent had run. So, you know, if you get 25 or 30 open House seats, plus you get, you know, a bunch of seats where Republicans hold the seat, but Hillary won the district, you know, there's plenty of targets for the Republicans.
Right.
Larry Sabato, who I think is a pretty good analyst, says he thinks it's 50-50 right now whether the House turns over. The Senate should be better just simply because of who's up next year. I mean, there are a lot of vulnerable Democrats in states like West Virginia and Montana and North Dakota, and Missouri, Ohio even, where Republicans should have a pretty good shot at a pickup in a normal year. The question is whether it'll be a normal year or whether the sort of the noise of investigation and scandal sort of overrides everything for the next year like it has this past year. If Trump can't get out of the way of that, if that continues to overhang the way it has, then views on him will be pretty fixed and may not change very much, even if the economy improves, maybe a little bit. And that's the real threat to Republicans, is if sort of this scandal environment, which the Democrats are feasting in and the media is feasting in, continues to damage, you know, the party in power.
Yeah, I would just add one thing. I mean, as I say, anything is possible a year from now. But I also think, and I don't have any tangible way of proving this other than just talking to people, I think a lot of this scandal stuff is turning off a lot of people in the sense that people are just tuning it out. I mean, because it's, you know, that's what I want to ask you next. It's about the Mueller investigation. Now we have the stories of the FBI. It just seems like, I mean, I can just picture a lot of people watching the newscast and saying, I'm just changing channels. This stuff is crazy. Because, I mean, it gets to a point where it's like, if you hate Trump, you're feasting in it. If you voted for Trump like I did, but was not exactly in love with him, you know, I support Trump because he's made some good choices and he's better than the alternative.
Sure.
But I think a lot of people out there must be sitting through this wondering what in the world is being investigated. I mean, and who exactly did what? And I'm just wondering, you know, the question I was asking you off the air, Richard, how can Judge or Director Mueller, I guess that's his formal title, how can he produce a report that anybody believes at this point? I mean, it seems like whatever he does, there's going to be half of the country will like it, the other half won't.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know how you can, you know, normally these kinds of reports are pretty much, you know, it's like, you know, you've got all the evidence and here it is and let's go forward.
Right.
But if there's just a lot of stuff in the middle and a lot of black, a lot of gray, not real black and white, I'm not sure it works, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, you're certainly right that the partisan split is so finely drawn right now that those who hate Trump, you know, part of the resistance, will never give him a break, whether he gets a clean report from Mueller or not. And those who like him are probably, like you said, just sort of worn out, and they've just sort of pulled back from even wanting to watch it. We were out of the country, my wife and I, for a few weeks, and it was like refreshing not to hear about this for 3 weeks. It was the sort of one of the positive aspects of it. But this is, I think, the problem, if there is one, for Trump, and that is the people who hate his guts may be more motivated at this point than those who are Trump supporters, who are sort of, you know, annoyed and bored with the scandal stuff, but it doesn't make them want to vote in great numbers. Generally, in midterms, you don't have as high a turnout as you get in presidential election years, and generally that helps Republicans because the biggest drop in turnout is among blacks and Hispanics. My guess is that the Hispanic vote will probably be pretty strong for the Democrats next time. The black vote may not be. You know, Hillary Clinton did not do as well as Obama among black voters, one of the reasons she lost states like Michigan and Pennsylvania. And so that, you know, that's a key part of the Democratic vote, and that may not show up. But among what I'll call the white resistance, turnout, you know, based on what we saw in the Virginia governor's race, you know, could be pretty high. And so Republicans are going to have to sort of work their voters to get him out, or, you know, they may wind up losing seats that were winnable simply because the Democratic base is more motivated.
Right, but it's still 25. You know, you still have 25 you have to flip.
Yeah, exactly. It's not
and that's
easy
still
to
a lot.
Yeah,
no, I mean, that's a lot to pick up. I think in 2006, they, you know, in 2006, the Democrats picked up 30-something.
Yep.
In 2010, the Republicans picked up, I think, 62 or something. So,
yep.
And so there's still a lot of seats to pick up. It's very much doable.
Right.
And I don't at this point in time, you know, who knows
it's
what
early.
Could happen. But it's way too early. Yes. But I am thinking that if you have a strong economy and hopefully all this stuff about Mueller is settled by then, hopefully a lot sooner than that for the sake of the American people. I just think, you know, there's potentially a good scenario there, but you're right. I mean, you never know. I mean, I guess the problem with the Hispanic vote is that, as I see it, the problem is so much of it is concentrated in districts that the Democrats are already going to win.
Yeah,
and
correct.
And I'm not so sure. I mean, if you had a huge turnout, for example, of Hispanics in let's say in Texas or in I don't know, California, or and most of them are already in districts.
Right.
That where you don't have a Republican. Now there's a couple of exceptions in South Texas,
right.
Where that could, that where they
right.
could, a couple of those could flip, and
right.
it, there could be a couple of flips in Florida, but I mean a massive Hispanic turnout in Missouri, I don't think is going to have much of an impact. Or
yeah, no, I mean,
so that's the thing about the Hispanic vote, that for one reason or another, it's concentrated primarily in districts. By the way,
right.
that's the other problem with DACA, not to change subjects, but one of the other problems with DACA, I was talking about this the other day when I was at Telemundo here in Dallas, that the problem with DACA is that 80% of the DACA dreamers live in five states, California, Texas, Illinois, New York, and Florida. And my guess is that those 80% probably live already in districts that
right.
are run by Democrats.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
they're going to have to persuade a lot of Republicans and, frankly, a lot of Democrats who are not getting calls.
Right.
In their office for supporting DACA, Richard.
Yeah. No, I think the bigger risk to Republicans from Hispanic vote is less on the district level, more on the state level. For instance, in 2016, Trump won Texas by 9%. Well, Romney had won it by 16%. Similarly, in Arizona, Trump won by 3%. Romney had won by 9%. Those are two states with very heavy Hispanic share of the total vote. California, the same thing. Trump did not nearly as well as Romney did, even though obviously the state was carried both times by Democrats. And the state that may have the biggest shift because of Hispanic vote may be Florida because of what happened in Puerto Rico. You've got a couple hundred thousand Puerto Ricans who have already moved to Florida, and they can vote right away. This is not like immigration where you got to wait 5 years if you win the lottery and you become a permanent resident, they can vote in the next election. So, for instance, the Florida Senate race, where the governor, who's Republican, may challenge the existing Democratic senator, and elections in Florida are always close. You know, they're always 1% or 2% or 3% at the most. That shift could make a sizable difference. One of the reasons the governor has gone out of his way to try to, you know, be welcoming to the people who moved in and create services for them and so on. But I think the statewide is where you – I think you're right that the districts for the House are not going to change much because of maybe a higher Hispanic turnout. But statewide vote totals where you have, you know, Senate elections or governor's races that could be influenced.
Absolutely. I mean, even here, Ted Cruz is running for re-election. He should win. I think the first time he
right.
won, like, by 17 points. I'm expecting close, not 17 this time, but maybe
right.
10 or so. But yeah, I mean, I think you're right. In Arizona, you're right. That could be a change. But, you know, we will have to wait and see. But I think a good economy is a good medicine for that.
Yeah.
No
and
question
about it. Everyone always tells you the first thing Americans think about – is their economic well-being. If they're better off,
right.
and Trump can articulate that they're better off because of policies he's made, it didn't just happen, which means, you know, having him focus on the stuff that matters rather
right.
than the stuff that doesn't, which distracts and gets him off message, then he could get some benefit from it.
Absolutely. Well, one thing about President Trump, is that he proved me wrong from July 2015 to the election. Mm-hmm. So
doing me and everybody else.
Yeah, that's right. Now, I thought he was going to lose. I came to believe that he was going to win toward the end of the election, like the last mm-hmm. 72 hours or so. I began to think that he was going to win because Hillary Clinton was doing some things that just didn't make any sense.
Yeah,
like
I agree.
Sending President Obama to Philadelphia and Detroit. Well, if you're still trying to get the black vote on the Friday before the election, you got problems.
Not a good sign. But not a good sign.
Not a good sign. And they were going to have a big fireworks display, and they canceled it the last few days. So they must have known something was not going right. But
they had the worst, worst candidate of all time. I mean,
That's it. And president. And the other thing going for the Democrats and or going against them, I think, is I don't think they've learned the lesson of 2016. I mean,
I agree.
Think they still they have a huge divide with the white working class vote. I don't see anything.
They look down on them more now than they did then. Rather than understanding that they drove them away by calling them deplorables and treating them like they were rubbish and flyover zone. The mm-hmm. Democrats have had a choice whether to, you know, sort of go back to the old Roosevelt coalition or to simply go with what they call rising America, which is, you know, minorities and the college-educated whites and Asians. And they're sticking to the new strategy. That's like they've written them off and saying, we're not going to do well. It's not worth the effort. We'll just count on, you know, Black Lives Matter and Dreamers, and that's going to carry us over the top.
I don't think so. I think if they think that, they're going to be disappointed, because I still think the key to their success is getting back some of those voters, so white voters.
I agree.
Richard, as always, thank you for your time. And if I don't talk before the end of the year with you, happy Christmas, happy New Year, everything that happens in this wonderful month of December.
Great.
And don't get too cold up there. And I hope the Bears win a couple of games.
I think they got the Browns left. That might be their
well, that might
shot.
Be a good shot. That might be
anyway, thanks
good
for the
shot.
Good wishes. It's always great to be on, and best to you and your family, Silvio.
Thank you so much, Richard. The same to you. Richard Baer, our good friend over at The American Thinker. We're going to take a little break. We're going to hear from my friend Carlos Guedes, and then we'll come back and with a couple of closing thoughts, as they like to say.
This is Carlos Guedes, Harpist, and I would like to see you guys this Saturday night at Nola Brasserie Authentic Cajun and Creole Restaurant, located at 1201 Main Street, downtown Dallas. I'll be performing instrumental high-energy jazz at 7:30 until midnight. So make your reservation today at 469-872-1820.
My good friend Carlos Guedes, he's playing around Dallas. We use his music on the radio show as well. We're very happy that we can do that. And he's playing all around Dallas. And my suggestion is, if you're on Facebook, check him out. Go to his public page. He's got a public page where he's got his whole schedule, where he's going to be around town. And I think you're going to find that anywhere he goes, the food is great. And the background music is just absolutely great. I mean, Carlos, of course, plays background music in most of these restaurants every once in a while. In a couple of places, people can dance, particularly on Friday and Saturday nights. And it's just fantastic. It's just absolutely fantastic. And as I say, check them out. If you live in Dallas, or if you're going to be coming to the Dallas area, check them out and get some good food, as they say, and enjoy some absolutely amazing music. Well, again, my thanks to Richard Baer over at The American Thinker. I have the great honor of posting over at The American Thinker. And today I had a post about Mexico and some of the corruption in Mexico and the difficulty of coming to terms with the corruption in Mexico, because the system is so corrupt from 6 or 7 decades of one-party rule that it makes it very difficult. Even if you try to, it is extremely difficult to solve the problem. One of the lessons I think that we in the United States can learn from Mexico and the corruption is that when you build these large bureaucracies, eventually become unaccountable. And especially if you switch political parties, which is the problem they've had, 2 out of the last 4 presidents have not been from the ruling party that held the country. So there are lots and lots of enemies in the bureaucracy to these presidents who are not from the party. and they just make his life miserable, which is what they've done to these presidents. So, for example, President Peña Nieto, who's president right now. Now, he is from the part of the PRI, or the party that held power for so long, but he's more of a reformer. He came in with the idea that he was going to make some reforms. He tried to do it with Pemex, the oil monopoly, and he really went after the teachers union. But as a consequence, you know, the teachers union, well, it's so corrupt. I mean, basically, he tried to improve it, tried to reform it, but then they reacted by closing streets and having demonstrations, and it just became a very difficult thing to do. And so even when you try, to reform, the system is so corrupt that it makes it very difficult to do so. So lesson for the United States, decentralize. Don't have a huge bureaucracy, and don't let the bureaucracy run the country. It really makes for a very difficult situation. Well, thank you for listening, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Again, my thanks to our friend Richard Baer of The American Thinker. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you the next time.